Welcome to Radio Naturopath, the talk show about health and natural medicine. This show will first be broadcast on Wednesday, October 22nd, 2025, on 91.7 FM WHUS Stores. I am Fran Storch, ND, naturopathic physician. My co-host Ron Meniza is too busy to make shows with me, so he's making them on another day. We're coming to you live from beautiful Mansfield Hollow, Connecticut. Comment below to let us know you're here and ask questions. You can also email me at radionaturopath@gmail.com. If you'd like to listen to the show at another time, you can check out our podcast at whus.org, iTunes, Spotify, Patreon, and Buzzsprout. You may also watch the recorded Facebook Live episode at Fran Storch ND for 30 days, and also on my YouTube channel at Radio Naturopath. The views expressed on this program do not reflect the views of the staff, management, or licensee of this station. The information presented on the show should not be construed as medical advice or direction. If you're having a medical condition, please consult with your physician. Here I am. Post-surgical, let's see, we're 4 weeks out, is that right? So let's see, September 19th is zero, so we're 4 weeks out. So it's been a month since my surgery, my goodness. So I'm still recovering, I still have nerve discomfort in that leg, and they tell me that's going to take a while to get better. The incision pain is getting better and better. I mean, I do get a little bit sore, but I remember 3 weeks ago sitting, my back would get a lot more, there would be a lot of pressure on my back and it was more of an inflammatory thing. And I haven't been needing to use Tylenol nearly as much. And so I'm using a lot less of that and a little bit of other things. But the things I'm using now are all natural medicine. So I'm using, you know, curcumin and fish oil, a bit of CBD and stuff like that, magnesium, evening primrose oil, black cumin seed oil, lots of oils that are anti-inflammatory. And so that incision pain is better. The nerve pain in my leg is still present. It's not so much that I can't walk or function, but it's definitely there. But I had another bump in the road, another snag, and that's that last weekend I was volunteering with the cyclocross race and I walked a lot. And God forbid I should walk 5,000 steps, right? 5,000 steps is a decent walk, but it doesn't seem like a lot. And in the course of that day, I walked 5,000 steps. And so my knee decided, my right knee, which has the arthritis in it, decided to go out. And I have medial pain. It's not that we don't think it's the medial collateral ligaments because my PT, and I've agreed in the past that you have to have a trauma, usually to the lateral side of your knee that then pushes against the knee and then you have a break in the medial collateral ligament. So I don't think that's what it is. Probably a meniscus. I definitely have osteoarthritis in that knee. So I said, all right, I'm going to have to, and I really was hoping to not need to go to the doctor for the knee until next year once I got healed from the surgery. But now I'm in a place where I can't walk straight because I'm still recovering from the back stuff and the knee is making it so I can't step on it properly. So I made an appointment with an orthopedist who specializes in sports medicine and who can help me with my knee, and he does non-surgical stuff. So I'm looking forward to that. I'm scheduled for a few weeks from now, which is unfortunate. So it's like the visit is 2.5 weeks out, something like that. And I have to wait for that unless they are able to get me in sooner. I'm on wait listed. So that's unfortunate. So in terms of my arthritic knee pain, I was using a hinged knee brace to keep things stable. I can still step on it. I just can't turn it at all. And so if I turn it at all, or if I put pressure on it, then I have pain. Otherwise I'm able to walk, but I can't put a lot of weight on it either. So what's interesting is young Will at Select Health, at Select PT, what he does when I go for my physical therapy, he puts me on the recumbent bike for, you know, 5 or 10 minutes before we do my exercises. And so I'm on the recumbent, so there's no pressure downward on my back and I can pedal with no weight and there's no pain in the knee when I do that. What I haven't tried to do is go downstairs and try Zwift. And that would put me in a position where I'm bent forward a bit. I'm going to try it and see if that position is comfortable. And if it's absolutely not comfortable, then I'll just go to the community center and hit the recumbent bike there, because I am able to do that. And I think it does it. And there's no pain when I'm on that recumbent bike. So I want to see if I'm on a regular bike, if I also have pain, and see what that does for my back. I know that I'm very limited as to how far I can bend forward. I can bend forward. It's just that I feel the pulling on my back, and I'm guessing that it's not good for my back to do that. So I have been doing some yoga, and when I do the yoga, if I do any kind of twisting, I twist to a point where I start to feel the pulling and then back off a little bit, so that I can still do the poses, I can still do the yoga, but I'm just not bending my back as more than I should. So I can get on the floor and do a spinal twist, but I get into the fetal position, so everything is facing one way, and I gently turn my torso in the other direction till I feel the pull, and then I back off. And so that's how I do it. So I'm able to do a little bit of stretchy yoga. I'm not doing vinyasa yoga where you go from poses standing up. And then I'm walking as part of my life, but I would like to get on the bike, at least on the trainer a little bit, and see if I'm able to do that. And then Will keeps adding on with these lovely PT exercises, which is great. And so I'm happy to do those. I'm able to do them, and I feel better when I do them. So that's good. And it makes me feel like I'm doing some kind of exercise. So anyway, in terms of supplements, when you have osteoarthritis in your knee or anywhere else, you can take things that reduce inflammation and also help to rebuild the cartilage. I don't know how much of that works. I've been taking collagen for a long time. Obviously, it's only helping so much with my back, and it's only helping so much with my knee. Maybe if I didn't take the collagen, it would be worse. I don't know. What I haven't tried is glucosamine, and I may just add that in, because some people, they do glucosamine and they do great. Also, there's a product called OsteoBiflex you can get at the drugstore, and people use that, and it works for them. It has a little bit of everything, a little bit of glucosamine and anti-inflammatory stuff. Don't know if I need to take that, because I think I'm taking the anti-inflammatory stuff. My concern is that Boswellia, which is frankincense, that's the name for frankincense. Frankincense is a wonderful anti-inflammatory. You can use the essential oil topically. You can get products with turmeric and boswellia that you can put on topically. I do have a coconut oil based product that has those oils in it, and I haven't been using it. I should really pull it out, because I really like it. And you can also take boswellia internally. And so there are products that have boswellia. You can get boswellia in phytosome form, so it's more absorbable. And that's available. Boswellia, generally, I'm believing, because I've tried products with boswellia in it, and it gives me a stomach ache. So what I haven't done is tried plain boswellia. And if I try, I might want to try that. And if it gives me an upset stomach, then I just can't do it. So that's why I'm usually staying away from products with boswellia in it, which is unfortunate, because, you know, that product from the drugstore, that we have one that comes from another company that I can get from my distributors. That's sort of a health food store brand, and that's very similar to that product. So I would love to try that, but I'm afraid I'll try it and it'll upset my stomach. What I haven't tried is the plain glucosamine. I could do glucosamine or glucosamine chondroitin or glucosamine chondroitin MSM. So glucosamine is, that's what your cartilage is basically made of. And so it sort of makes sense to try it, because it's a building block for your cartilage. And so on the one hand, I've read that it's not useful to take chondroitin, because what happens is when you take chondroitin, your body breaks the chondroitin down into its components, including glucosamine, and then rebuilds the chondroitin in your cartilage. So why bother? Just take the glucosamine. The glucosamine will work just as well. Having said that, on the other hand, there are studies that show when people take a glucosamine chondroitin product, it does help with their pain and helps to rebuild their joints. So I may try that. And then MSM is a very absorbable form of sulfur, and sulfur is part of the substance of the cartilage in your body, and it's a general anti-inflammatory, and your body will use it for various sulfur-bearing antioxidants and anti-inflammatory compounds like glutathione. And in general, it does help with inflammation. So you can get products that have all three. So I may try one of those, either the plain glucosamine. I'm curious to try the plain glucosamine first to see how that might work. So some people take glucosamine and they find it very helpful. And I haven't done that, so I could do that. So I'm considering it. All right. So that's what's going on with that. Ron was doing very well for a very long time. And when he's very active, he gets some neck discomfort. And in the last couple of days, he's had a little more pain and cramping. And he's not sure why. He hadn't cramped in many months since the surgery, but now he's having some cramping. So I don't know if something shifted, if he needs an adjustment. So we're trying to see about what's going on with that. Because he's getting better and better, but he's also getting more and more active. So he's having some symptoms sometimes. And so I don't think that recovery from these surgeries is a steady up and up and up. It's an up and down thing. It's a steady improvement, but you have peaks and valleys within the improvement. I think that's what I'm thinking. And I'm hoping that I'm simply being impatient in terms of the pain in my leg, because I definitely still have nerve discomfort in my leg. I was talking to my friend Steve, who had the same surgery I did a few years back, and he said the nerve pain doesn't go away right away. So that, and he also has flares, and he said I'm a little bit flared right now, so I shouldn't expect to be all better. It's a month out and the nerve pain is not significantly improved, but it's not like it was when I had the acute horrible flare where I couldn't walk on it. I mean, that at that point, there was no position I could get in and be comfortable. And that's not true at all. If I'm not using the leg, I can't feel it. If I put my hand on the leg, I can feel that there's some numbness there. So we're carrying on. I am so hoping I can do something about this knee without having to get surgery, and certainly not a replacement. And if I do have to have surgery, would I be able to just have arthroscopy? But Dr. Toylan, who I'm going to go see, he specializes in, again, non-invasive therapies. So they will be ultrasounds and injections and things like that. And he calls himself Valley Sports Medicine. So what I want to do is I don't want to just be out of pain. I would like to be able to do sports. I would like to be able to ride my bike and walk and hike, maybe even run a little bit if I feel like it. Definitely do yoga and do my weight training and not have to worry about it. So I think that the surgical site is not completely healed yet either. And I'm just a little concerned that because I have to be active, because I have to go to work, that it's taking longer because I can't, attend to it every minute. I have to be walking around and doing things. So anyway, that's what's going on there. All right. So there's a big thing in the news. If you're paying attention, it was in all of the news outlets. I heard it on the Today Show and on NBC and CNN and NPR and any news outlet you want to think about. There's lead in protein powders. Oh my God. So people take protein powders. I'm one of them. I take protein powder every day. And but there's a concern that there's lead in protein powders. And because Consumer Reports did a report and they found higher than their level of concern of lead in protein powders. And the highest levels of lead were found in plant-based protein powders. So why would that be? It's because anything that interacts with the soil is going to bioaccumulate heavy metals. And when you take the protein, you're taking the plant protein. You're not taking the plant in its whole form. When you take a plant in its whole form, you're getting a lot of the fiber. So a lot of what you're eating is fiber. So if there's any lead in the plant that it got from the soil, the fiber is probably going to make it so that you excrete most of that lead. So when people eat vegetables or organic vegetables, getting lead in your vegetables is not that much of a concern unless you have a heavily contaminated soil for some reason. There are certain plants that tend to bioaccumulate heavy metals more than others, and rice is one of them. And that's probably part of the problem with the plant protein powders, because rice sits in a paddy, and a paddy is wet. And so when you have groundwater has metals in it. And so when you have the rice can bioaccumulate the heavy metals that are in the water at a greater rate than if the plant is sitting above the ground and it's not sitting in a paddy. Paddies are like a pond that are full of these rice plants. So rice tends to bioaccumulate heavy metals, especially arsenic. But the metal of concern that was tested for Consumer Reports was lead. And chocolate has some level of lead in it. So if you get a chocolate-flavored protein powder, you're going to have a little more lead than if you got a different flavor, vanilla or banana or strawberry or salted caramel, my favorite, or what have you. So what Consumer Reports found is they found that the protein powder types that had the least amount of lead in it were whey and collagen. So that's interesting. So collagen doesn't have bones in it, so the collagen doesn't particularly bioaccumulate the lead the same way that maybe bones do. And whey is not, it's milk, so milk is going to have been filtered through the animal's udders and then the whey taken out. And the whey doesn't tend to bioaccumulate in milk. So when you separate the whey out, there's not a significant amount of lead in it. The problem is that a lot of people are dairy intolerant. I can't take whey protein to save myself. That gives me such terrible cramps. If you are not dairy intolerant and you tolerate whey, if you get grass-fed organic whey, that's probably the best protein powder. It's the most absorbable. It has immune globulins in it. It's very, very bioavailable. It has glutamine in it, which is the chief fuel for your digestive system. So it's a really good protein powder. It's just that, you know, not everybody tolerates dairy. And so that's my problem. And I didn't feel like I did as well with the plant proteins. I'm okay with yellow pea protein, and I'll have a protein bar that has pea protein or something else in it. But I tend to do really well with the bone broth protein. And I have a concern that there's some lead level in my bone broth protein. The brand that we use was not one of the ones that was studied. In fact, I don't know if the Consumer Reports study did bone broth protein. So Chris Kresser has an opinion about bone broth protein. The thing is, bone broth protein and beef-based proteins. They did test some beef-based proteins, and the beef-based protein did have some significant levels of lead in them. So in terms of bone broth protein, I looked at Chris Kresser, and you know, Chris Kresser is a holistically oriented, I believe he's a chiropractor, and he wrote an article a few years ago about bone broth and lead toxicity, should you be concerned? And so this is from a few years ago, this is from 6 years ago. And there was a journal in Medical Hypothesis that stated that the risk of lead contamination in bone broth diets, that was the study. They mentioned that the consumption of bone broth may be increasing because it's recommended by the GAPS and paleo diets. And it's established that farm animals and humans can be exposed to lead by way of food, water, air, dust, and soil, and that accumulates in bones. The researchers wanted to find out whether the bones in farm animals might sequester lead, which would then be released into broth during its preparation. So they studied proteins that use chicken bones, chicken meat without the bones, and chicken skin and cartilage without the bones. And in each case, they used the same tap water, cooking utensils, cookware, and cooking time, and found, and also a fourth control preparation where they followed the procedure but used only tap water heated for the same length of time. So the chicken bone broth had 7 micrograms per liter. The bone broth from chicken meat without bones, only 2.3 micrograms per liter. And bone broth made from skin and cartilage off the bone, 9.5 micrograms per liter. The control had 0.9 micrograms per liter. So nothing was lead-free. So the levels of lead in bone broth made from chicken bones was a little over 7 times higher than the tap water and 10 times higher in bone broth from chicken skin than chicken skin and cartilage. Lead, of course, has adverse medical effects on your central nervous system, peripheral nervous system, your blood system, and your GI tract and kidneys and cardiovascular system, endocrine, all kinds of systems. Too much lead is not good for you. So should you quit bone broth? So how much lead is safe? The authors of the study express alarm about high levels of lead found in the bone broth preparations, but the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency has established that a safety threshold of 15 parts per billion, which is equivalent to 15 micrograms per liter for lead in drinking water. They explain that most studies show that exposure to lead-contaminated water alone would not be likely to elevate blood levels in most adults, even exposure to water with a lead content close to the 15 parts per billion EPA limit. But the risk will vary, however, depending on the individual, the circumstances, and the amount of water consumed. So infants who drink formula with lead-contaminated water are going to be at a higher risk because of the large volume of water relative to their body size. If drinking water consistently through the day with lead levels of 15 micrograms per liter isn't a problem for human adults and children, with the exception of adult infants drinking formula, so why would 2.3 cups of bone broth with lead levels of 9.5 micrograms per liter pose a problem? Dr. Kresser doesn't think it would. And there's additional factors to consider that may make lead in homemade chicken broth even less of a concern. So there's no doubt that it's smart to minimize exposure to toxins as much as possible. But in an environment where toxins are found in foods that also contain beneficial nutrients, you have to balance the benefits of the nutrients against the harms of the toxins. That makes sense. And some nutrients protect against the harmful effects of toxins. So selenium products protect against mercury toxicity in fish. So the reason mercury is toxic is that it damages selenium-dependent enzymes that play a crucial role in protecting you from oxidative damage. That's why you've heard so much publicity about the dangers of consuming fish with mercury. However, what the reports don't consider is that if a food you consume has more selenium than mercury, or if background selenium intake is high, mercury won't be able to destroy all your selenoenzymes and you'll be protected from the toxic effects. So certain nutrients like calcium, iron, vitamin D, vitamin C, and thiamine have similar protective effects against lead toxicity. So those nutrients are available and you eat a lot of them if you eat a paleo diet or the GAPS, that's the gut and psychology diet. And in the case of calcium, abundant in bone broth itself. So calcium in human and animal studies show that when you have low calcium intake, it increases your risk of lead toxicity. In one rat study, researchers found that rats ingesting a low calcium diet had blood lead concentrations 4 times higher than rats on a normal calcium diet. All the quantity of lead ingested were equal. The mechanisms by which calcium protects against lead toxicity involves complex interactions among lead, dietary calcium, calcium-binding proteins, and vitamin D. In fact, the interaction between calcium and lead is quite similar to that of selenium and mercury. One of the ways it causes harm is by interfering with the beneficial effects of calcium. Lead is known to mimic calcium in biological systems or to alter calcium-mediated cellular responses, complete with calcium and enzyme systems, impair calcium metabolism, or inhibit 125D-mediated regulation of calcium metabolism. It's also been shown to reduce the absorption of lead in the GI tract. Studies show that susceptibility to lead toxicity is influenced by nutritional iron status. A study in the 70s found that rodents fed an iron-deficient diet experienced increased susceptibility to lead toxicity. So, and then there's vitamin D, C, and thiamine, though less is known about how those nutrients protect against toxicity. D appears to modify lead distribution once it's been absorbed, preventing its incorporation into bone. Vitamin C has been shown to have chelating properties, which help remove lead from the body. And B1 in here appears to inhibit the uptake of lead cells and promote lead excretion. And I've been taking benfotiamine, which has activated B1, so I'm probably getting protection from lead that way. It's also plausible that the diet and living conditions of the animals we use to make bone broth will significantly influence lead levels in their bones, and therefore the broth. Food, water, soil, and dust are the largest sources of exposure to lead in farm animals, and that cereal grains contribute the most to dietary exposure to lead. So since there's not a lot of comparative data on this, it's reasonable to assume that pasture-raised chickens who eat a combination of forage and grain-based feed would have lower lead levels than conventionally raised chickens that eat only grain-based feed. And so if the beef that your bone broth comes from is grass-fed, it's going to be less likely to have lead in it. So given that the lead in the chicken broth tested by medical hypothesis were low the EPA established safe upper limit for drinking water, and given the protective effect of several nutrients in the paleo GAPS diet and bone broth itself, it's unlikely that you're going to have a problem if you're doing chicken-based bone broth. So that's interesting. So bone broth protein is probably not a problem. So the deal is, yes, they found lead in these proteins, but if you eat an overall healthy diet and you are then exposed to lead, you're going to be more likely to be able to excrete that lead. And especially if you're getting adequate vitamin C, vitamin D, iron, vitamin B1, which you're going to get if you eat a broad, lots of vegetables and fruit, nuts and seeds, clean protein. Your nuts and seeds are going to have zinc and selenium in them. I had this great conversation a while back with Paul, who's the fish buyer at the fish market in Willimantic. And I've often talked to him about, you know, because they sell tuna steaks there. And he says that he gets tuna steaks from small tuna. So they are too small to significantly bioaccumulate lead. And he also said if your selenium status is good, that you're going to excrete the lead anyway. So I may go back to taking a little bit of selenium every day, or maybe I'll take it on alternate days. That sounds like a good idea. That I'll take my selenium on alternate days. Anyway, so if you have, if you eat nuts and seeds and you eat a varied diet and you eat organic foods, you're going to get adequate selenium and zinc. So he talked about, there was a study on people in the Seychelles, which is an island, a set of islands in the Pacific. And in the Seychelles, they eat a lot of lead, of heavy metal, mercury-bearing fish. But they don't have significant mercury accumulation because their diet is high in selenium. And the selenium helps you to detoxify the lead. So you're superoxide dismutase and your glutathione are going to help you to get rid of extra lead. So if I take NAC and vitamin C and selenium, I will make myself some glutathione. You can also take glutathione if you want to. But if you eat a varied, you don't necessarily have to take those. If you eat a varied and healthy diet, probably going to be okay. All right, so that's what's going on. So the bottom line is, if you're very concerned about lead being in your protein powders, you might want to consider not having protein powder every day or only having a small amount. You might want to consider having flavors that are not chocolate, because chocolate in general can have a bit higher lead in it. And if you eat a lot of chocolate, I don't know how, what people's lead levels, if they happen to eat a lot of chocolate, are. But chocolate has some lead burden in it. And if you're that concerned, you may want to get flavors that are not chocolate. And your protein powders come, they often come in vanilla. The bone broth is one of the bone broth brands, does banana and strawberry. And one of my favorites is salted caramel. So if you can get flavors that are not chocolate, that's another way to do it. So whey overall has the least, but of course, if you're dairy intolerant, that's not going to work for you. Grass-fed beef is going to have less lead in it than grain-fed beef, because there's grains can bioaccumulate heavy metals, especially rice. But you know that usually when cattle are fed grain, they're fed corn. So if they're not concerned about what kind of corn the animals are getting, the corn can bioaccumulate metals too. So grass is going to have less bioaccumulation of metals than corn and other grains. So if you have grass-fed beef protein and free-range chicken protein, then you're going to have less bioaccumulation of lead. And then it seems that the vegetarian proteins, the ones that are vegan, they have the most lead burden, because the grains tend to bioaccumulate lead. So if you eat a lot of rice, are you going to bioaccumulate arsenic? It's not nothing. And yet, I don't think you have to stop eating rice. I think the thing to do is to make sure you're not mostly eating rice, that you're also eating fruits and vegetables, nuts and seeds, and lots of vegetables and fruit. And so that you have, if you're eating a high fiber diet and you're getting a good poop in once or twice a day, that's another way that you excrete metals. You excrete toxins from your body through your stool. So eating a high fiber diet is going to help with that. And if you have a good digestive system and you're going one you can go as many as three times a day, and it's fine. As long as everything's fine, you're not having gas and bloating, and everything is comfortable and you have formed stools, everything is fine. It's fine to go that much a day. I have people who complain, oh, I'm off schedule. I used to go all at once in the morning, but now I'm going maybe twice. And sometimes I have to go when I leave the house, and people don't like to go outside their homes. So my recommendation about, I understand that. Some people like to be comfortable and safe when they're going number two. And it is nicer to go in your house than it is to go somewhere else. And I used to be terrible that way. My mother said that after I was toilet trained, I wouldn't go anywhere else, even when she would need me to go outside because we were not near a bathroom. And I got over that mostly for, I can go in the woods if I'm on a bike ride or something like that. But in terms of, you know, being ashamed, because people go into public restrooms where there are stalls and they're ashamed because it makes smells, it makes sounds, and people are embarrassed that they're going to the bathroom in front of other people. If you can just get over that, you know, so what's the worst that can happen? Somebody's gonna be like, they're gonna make a sound, but it's much better not to hold it and to go when you're out than it is to hold it. It's so bad for you to hold it. If you've been diagnosed with diverticulosis, one of the ways you get diverticulosis is chronic constipation. You have stool that's sitting in your colon for a long time, and it, because it's sitting there, it's pressing against the walls of your colon, and it's giving you poor colonic tone. And when you have that poor colonic tone, it's a vicious cycle. It makes it harder to go to the bathroom because that poor tone makes it so it's hard to have good peristalsis, muscular movement of the colon, to get everything out. So if you have to go to the bathroom, you should go to the bathroom and try not to worry about if there's something else in there. If it really bothers you, one of the things you can do is there are scented products, sprays you can carry, and you can carry them in your purse, and you spray the toilet water before you go to the bathroom, and it makes a pretty scented covering, and it tends to, and I think it increases the surface tension of the water, so that when you go to the bathroom, it goes through it and it keeps the odors in, and it smells pretty. You know, it'll be lavender or citrus or, you know, cinnamon or some kind of nice scent. And, you know, people often put sprays in the bathroom, but those with the essential oils, they tend to be the nicest. And if they're made for spraying in the toilet before you go, we tend to keep them in our bathroom at the office. And you can get them at the grocery store, and you can get them online. And if it worries you that much, just carry one with you. Now, of course, then there's the sounds that you can't do anything about, you know, so. My advice is, it's okay to make noise when you go to the bathroom, and only somebody who's really compromised is going to say something to you about it. So you heard it here. If you have to go to the bathroom, go to the bathroom, and it doesn't matter where it is. You know, it's so much healthier for you to go when you need to go, because it can cause problems if you don't. And the biggest thing that it will cause is it will give you poor colonic tone. And then, of course, if stool sits inside you too long, one of the things that happens is the reason stool is stool is because it's supposed to come out of you. And it's got all kinds of stuff that's supposed to come out of you, like heavy metals, like bile acids, like metabolites of things that your body doesn't want to use anymore. Anything that your liver gets rid of, that's put into bile, goes into your stool. So that's all of your metabolic metabolites. That's any toxins from the environment. That's any metabolites of heavy metals. They all go in your stool. They also go in your kidneys, into your bladder as well, which is why you should go to the bathroom if you need to do that as well, and drink lots of water. So you don't want those things sitting around, because what happens is, for example, hormones, which get conjugated, they go through your liver. When your body's trying to level out your hormone levels, your estrogen, progesterone, other reproductive hormones, in order to tag it for leaving your body, it tags it with a hydroxyl group, which is basically a piece of water. And it makes it more water soluble instead of fat soluble. And when it's water soluble, it dissolves into bile better, and then out it goes. So if you have estrogen or testosterone or progesterone sitting in your colon waiting for excretion and it waits too long, you'll get unfriendly bacteria that has beta-glucuronidase in it, and it will break the bond of that hydroxyl group, and now you have activated hormone again, and then you reabsorb it from your colon. So you don't want that to happen. So if things are coming out regularly, you're just going to be so much healthier in so many ways. It just feels better. You know, you feel better when that's going on. But there's a lot of reasons why that's happening. If you're very constipated, you can have symptoms like bowel gas, cramping, pain, but you can also get lightheaded. You can also get brain fog and just not feel well. So it's really worth making sure you go to the bathroom. So we got here from the proteins. So if you're going to take a protein, you can consider not taking it every day and getting your protein from, you know, clean animal protein elsewhere. So grass-fed beef, free-range chicken, cleanly raised or wild-caught fish. And you can also consider, if you can do whey protein, do whey protein. If you can't, then consider grass-fed beef or grass-fed and free-range bone broth or chicken protein. And the proteins, the protein powders that tend to have the highest bioaccumulation of metals are the vegan ones. So if you're a vegan and you need protein powders, you might want to find one that has been, that says on it that it has lower lead levels, if that's possible. And also consider just getting your protein other ways and just making sure you eat plenty of beans, nuts, seeds, whole grains, and that you're getting your protein in general that way. Sometimes it's hard to hit protein goals when you're a vegan, but then you know, a lot of vegans live happy, healthy lives, probably not eating the level of protein that I eat, because I eat animal protein. So that was exciting, because that was on the news very recently. It was like all the news networks. If you go online and you look at all the news networks, all of the news has a study about the Consumer Report study on lead levels in protein powders. And every news source I was watching on TV, same thing. It was on NBC, it was on CNN, it was on ABC. Everybody reported on it. So it was interesting. So I thought I'd talk about it because some of you are taking protein powders. Okay, so we had started talking about monounsaturated fats last week. And so let's go back to that. And let me see where I was. We were talking about how they can help with, we started by talking about how monounsaturated fats, first of all, monounsaturated fats are oleic acid, palmitic oleic acid, and vaccinic acid. And what makes them a monounsaturated fat is because they're long chains of carbon molecules, and they have, what makes them a fat is they have hydroxyl groups on them. So when you have a monounsaturated fat has only one hydroxyl group, that's why it's called monounsaturated. So a saturate, when carbon bonds are saturated, that means that there's only one bond connecting carbon A to carbon B, and there's four spots for stuff to bond on any one carbon atom. So when you have a carbon in the middle of a chain, you have carbon A attached to carbon B. And if it's saturated, that means it's not going to have any double bonds or triple. It's only going to have a single bond from carbon A to carbon B, which means there's four spots for other stuff to bond. And so typically in the long chain, carbon A will be bonded to carbon B. That's one. And then carbon B will also be bonded to carbon C. So that's two bonds. And then everything else will then can be bonded to other things that are off of it. So if it's not, doesn't have a hydroxyl group or an amino group or some other kind of group, it's going to have hydrogen attached to it. And it otherwise can have a hydroxyl group or an amino group or something like that. But a monounsaturated fat is going to have, it's going to be CH3 at one end, and then it's going to be singly bonded to another carbon. That carbon is going to have two hydrogens attached to it and then be bonded to the next carbon. And that's going to go down the line until you get to carbon number 9. Number 9. Get to carbon number 9. Now, carbon 9 bonded to carbon number 10 is a double bond because it's unsaturated. And it's not going to be a triple bond because that would make it an ethene. So, like acetylene is would be an example of an ethene because it has a triple bond in it. Nature doesn't care for triple bonds, and things with triple bonds like acetylene are very unstable, and they can break down and cause free radical damage. And acetylene is one of the things that your body makes when you are recovering from a hangover, when you've drunk too much, because it's one of the metabolic steps in the breakdown of alcohol. And so one of the reasons you get a hangover is you have triple bonded stuff, and then you need lots of water to take care of it. But before you get that lots of water, you can have some free radical damage in your brain, and that gives you inflammation and headaches and all that stuff. So anyway, your monounsaturated fat is going to have the first double bond, or the single double bond, at carbon number 9. And that's it. And it's going to go down the rest of the line and until it gets to the other end. And I believe it has a hydroxyl group at the end. And that's what a monounsaturated fat is. So monounsaturated fats are usually liquid at room temperature, but they also don't have a very high or they don't have a very low melting point. So their melting point, that's why if it gets too cold in your house, the olive oil will start to congeal. And if you don't put olive oil in the fridge, because it congeals. And it is an amorphous solid, so it congeals at a range of temperatures. And that temperature, I'm not sure what the temperature of olive oil congealing in, and it's a range of temperatures, but it's probably somewhere certainly in the 50s, maybe in the 60s. And so I know that when our house gets into the 60s, the olive oil doesn't congeal. So it might be lower than that, might be in the 50s. Certainly when you get into the 40s Fahrenheit, right? So anyway, so that's what a monounsaturated fat is. We already said that they can help with fat loss, reduce your body fat, help you to burn more fat. Can reduce the risk of cardiovascular disease. People on Mediterranean diets tend to have lower rates of cardiovascular disease, and we tend to promote the Mediterranean diet as one of the healthiest diets you can eat. And monounsaturated fats might reduce cancer risk. This is where we left off last week. So when you look at the role of high monounsaturated fat diets, there's a protective effect. There's some studies that show protective effect, some no effect, and some harmful. So it depends on the study you look at. And that there was a study in 2020 on oleic acid, which is most abundant in olive oil, saying that it can lower cancer risk and have a protective effect against cancer. But another study showed that MUFA can have growth-stimulating effects on kidney cancer cells. And then another study found that some unsaturated fatty acids like MUFAs may decrease the risk of digestive cancer. So overall, the news is good. If you have kidney cancer, you may want to skip olive oil. Or if you have a family history of kidney cancer. But if you don't, it tends to be protective. The studies showed that there's a general protection against cancer, and then particularly a protection against digestive cancers. Olive oil has antioxidants in it that counteract cancer cell growth. And there were studies on prostate cancer, and that was found to be inconclusive. And then there was a cohort study that found that there was an increased risk of prostate cancer with monounsaturated fats. So that's concerning. But, I mean, prostate cancer is rare, and there are lots of really healthy guys who eat a lot of olive oil, and they don't get prostate cancer. So this is one study. There's recent studies on the association between cancer and monounsaturated fats, but they're observational. So they can't necessarily show a cause and effect, because people don't just eat olive oil, and they don't just eat olives. They eat lots of different things. So they look at, cultures that eat a lot of olive oil, and they make presumptions from that. So Monounsaturated fats may improve insulin sensitivity. Insulin, of course, is a hormone that controls your blood sugar. It moves sugars from the blood into your cells. And your insulin production is important for preventing high blood sugar and type 2 diabetes. And there was a study in 2023 that shows that avocado intake may be associated with better blood sugar regulation in people with diabetes. So I would have to assume that it's also going to be good for blood sugar regulation in anyone. Avocados, as long as you like them, they're a superfood. They're really good for you in so many ways. They give you a lot of fiber. The monounsaturated fats are anti-inflammatory. They help to lower cholesterol. The fibers in them help to lower cholesterol and the monounsaturated fats. And they can help with fat loss too. So avocados are a superfood. There are studies that show an association when a higher dietary intake of unsaturated fat improves insulin resistance in older adults, females, people who are obese, and those who have high cholesterol. Compared to polyunsaturated fats, monounsaturated fats may be preferred for fasting insulin if you're trying to lower your blood sugar. Monounsaturated fats may reduce inflammation. So if they're going to help with cardiovascular disease, they're going to help to reduce inflammation. Inflammation is your immune system process that helps your body to fight infection. And sometimes inflammation happens slowly, which can contribute to chronic metabolic diseases like obesity, type 2 diabetes, metabolic dysfunction. Now they're calling, this is interesting, I didn't realize this, that non-alcoholic fatty liver disease is now known as metabolic dysfunction-associated steatotic liver disease. So in other words, you get fat accumulation in your liver and you're not particularly drinking a lot of alcohol. So now it's called Masold instead of Nefold. Who knew? So anyway, monounsaturated fats can help to protect against that. When you swap saturated fats for unsaturated, you may help with inflammation related to those conditions. And high saturated fat and Western diets, high MUFA diets like the Mediterranean diet can reduce inflammation. And when they put mice on a MUFA-rich diet, which, how much does that relate to people? It's to some extent. A 15-week MUFA-rich diet in the mice, they had lower levels of pro-inflammatory markers. It's easier to examine mice than it is to examine humans, because humans have to take time off work and they have to, show up. And mice, you just have them. Of course, then you can question whether it's, humane to use animals in research, which I'm not going to debate at the moment here. What are you going to eat when you eat your MUFAs? What foods have the MUFAs? Let's talk about that. Plant and animal-based foods both contain some MUFAs. Fatty fish like salmon, in addition to having omega-3 fatty acids, they also have omega-9s. So who knew? Some evidence suggests that plant-based sources of MUFAs are more desirable than animal-based sources relative to coronary artery disease risk. And that may be because there are additional saturated fats in red and processed animal meat. So here's some high MUFA foods. Extra virgin olive oil. There's 9.8 grams in a tablespoon. Raw almonds have 10.4 grams in an ounce. Dry roasted unsalted cashews have 9.1 grams in an ounce. So if you eat a lot of nuts and seeds, you're going to get your MUFAs. Raw Virginia peanuts, they have 8.5 grams an ounce. And pistachios, 7.8 grams in an ounce. Green olives, 11.3 grams in 100 grams. Pumpkin seeds have 20.9 grams in a cup, but you're generally not going to eat a whole cup of, when I eat pumpkin seeds, I'm eating a teaspoon to a tablespoon and that's it. Ground pork has 7.9 grams in 3 ounces. Avocados, a whole avocado has 19.7 grams of monounsaturated fats. So when I eat a salad, Ron gives me half an avocado, and it's a small avocado, so I'm probably getting something like 7 to 10 grams of monounsaturates in that avocado. And then I put nuts and seeds in my salad, too. And sunflower seeds, a whole cup has 25 grams, more than the pumpkin seeds. Again, because you're eating, these seeds are very little, so you're going to eat more seeds, so you're going to get more general monounsaturated. They take up less space, too, because they're small. You're not going to eat a whole cup at a time. So the thing to do is to eat a variety of things over the course of the day. So over time, it adds up. Hard-boiled eggs, one large egg has 2.04 grams, which isn't huge. That's an animal protein. There's more, as you can see, there's more monounsaturates in plant foods than there is in animal foods. So they're healthy fats. They're most commonly found in olive oils, avocados, nuts, seeds, and some meat. Diets high in monounsaturated fat can help with weight loss and may reduce risk factors for heart disease, promote heart health as long as they don't add extra calories. Foods that have MUFAs, like olive oil, may also help reduce cancer risk, inflammation, and risks of inflammatory conditions, and insulin resistance. And it's important to eat other types of fat if you replace unhealthy fats, particularly trans fats and polyunsaturated fats, especially ones that have been heated in like seed oils. It can provide a lot of health benefits. So that's your monounsaturated fats. So MUFAs are basically good for you. All right, so before we leave you, let's jump into seed oils, all the controversy about seed oils. Hopefully we can finish out with the seed oils. So are vegetable and seed oils bad for your health? They can be a healthy source of fat. Some varieties are better choices than others. And the often mentioned adverse effects of omega-6 fats may not be as clear as previously believed. So vegetable oils has increased dramatically in the past century. Most mainstream health professionals consider them healthy, but vegetable oils can cause health problems. Their health effects vary depending on what fatty acids they contain, what plants they come from, and how they're processed. So edible oils extracted from plants are known as vegetable oils, and they're used in cooking and baking, processed foods, salad dressings, margarine, mayonnaise, cookies. That includes soybean, canola, and safflower oil. Refined vegetable oils weren't available until the 20th century when we had the technology to start extracting them. And health-conscious consumers prefer oils that are made by crushing or pressing plants or seeds than those that are made by using chemicals. The consumption has increased a lot. In the past century, vegetable oil consumption has increased at the expense of other fats like butter. They're labeled heart-healthy and recommend an alternative to sources of saturated fat like butter, lard, and tallow. Vegetable oils are considered heart healthy because studies consistently link polyunsaturated fat to reduced risk of heart problems compared with saturated fat. Despite the potential health benefits, sometimes it's just worry about how much of these oils people consumed, and the concern is about omega-6. It is important to note that not all plant oils are bad for you, like avocado and olive oil, because of the monounsaturates. Omega-6 and omega-3 fats are essential fatty acids, meaning you need some of them in your diet because your body can't make them. Through evolution, humans got omega-6 and 3 in a certain ratio. While this ratio differed between populations, it's estimated to be about 1 to 1. In the past century or so, the ratio in the Western diet shifted to be as high as 20 to 1. And there's research that hypothesized that too much omega-6 relative to omega-3 can contribute to chronic inflammation. But a more recent study from this year did not show this connection between higher omega-6 and inflammation. Chronic inflammation is an underlying factor in some of the most common Western diseases. Observational studies have also associated a high intake of omega-6 with an increased risk of heart disease. Though the associations don't imply a causal relationship. So again, if you are eating a little bit of omega-6, like you have a chip habit, but you're eating a lot of fruits and vegetables, healthy nuts and seeds, avocado, olive oil, you may be okay. So if you eat a lot of linoleic acid, which is the most common omega-6 fats, it doesn't seem to increase risks of inflammatory markers. But plant oils that are high in omega-6, so you don't get that ratio where you're 20 to 1 instead of the 1 to 1 or even 3 or 4 to 1 more helpful for you. Soybean, corn oil, cottonseed, sunflower, peanut oil, sesame oil, and rice bran oil are higher in omega-6s. So there are studies that are needed to see what they actually do in your body. It's more important to limit processed foods high in omega-6 fats, like baked treats, chips, deep-fried fast foods, or takeout meals, because they have more effects on your health. So when you overheat any kind of polyunsaturated fat, omega-6, or usually omega-6, you're going to get free radical damage. So your chips and your deep fried and your fried foods from the takeout, those are going to be issues. So saturated monounsaturated and polyunsaturated fats differ by the number of double bonds, which we already talked about. Saturated has no double bonds, monounsaturated one double bond, and polyunsaturated two or more double bonds. All the double bonds make them susceptible to oxidation, like we talked about. They react with oxygen in the atmosphere and start deteriorating. The fat you eat isn't only stored as fat tissue or burned energy, it's also incorporated into your cell membranes. So if you have a high level of fragile fatty acids that can be degraded to make harmful compounds called free radicals, that can cause cell damage. That's why it's better to eat polyunsaturated fats in moderation. Eat a healthy mix of saturated, mono, and polyunsaturated fats. And polyunsaturates when they get oxidized, they can form trans fats. So food producers use hydrogenation to harden vegetable oils, making them solid like butter. Margarines no longer are full of trans fats because there is an FDA ban 10 years ago, and that went into effect in 2018 with an extended deadline for some food manufacturers. So margarines now still have a small amount of trans fats, and natural trans fats are found in small amounts compared to hydrogenated oils. There's a high association of trans fats with chronic diseases like heart disease, obesity, cancer, and diabetes. And if a product lists hydrogenated oil or partially hydrogenated oil as an ingredient, it probably has trans fats in it. For optimal health, it's a good idea to avoid those products. Vegetable oils and heart disease. So vegetable oils are recommended for those with risk of heart disease. They're generally low in saturated fat and high in polyunsaturated, but the benefits of reduced saturated fat is controversial. There were some studies that showed reducing saturated fat for 2 years reduced the risk of cardiovascular problems by 21%, but no effects on the risk of death from heart disease. Omega-3 polyunsaturated fatty acids have a greater benefit than omega-6 fatty acids. So linoleic acid has been associated with a lower risk of heart disease, but you want to be vigilant about avoiding highly refined vegetable oils and processed foods that have those oils. So the big thing is that vegetable oils, they can be okay, but if they're deep fried or heated, they're in chips or takeout or baked goods, they might not be so good for you. That's why we don't cook with polyunsaturated fats. We cook in our house with avocado oil, with olive oil, and with virgin coconut oil, which has medium chain triglycerides in it, so they're less likely to break down in heating. And then you want to limit the amount of chips you eat. You can get potato chips that are baked in avocado oil or olive oil exclusively, and those are going to be a better choice than if they're in seed oils. So, because monounsaturated fats are ultimately better for you than omega-6s. Now, there is gamma-linolenic acid, which is in borage oil, blackcurrant seed oil, and even primrose oil. And that is a great anti-inflammatory omega-6 fatty acid. If you take a little bit of that, that's going to be good for you. The problem is when you're getting these seed oils and they are used for cooking and frying and they've been heated, and that's when it becomes a problem. So limiting those is a really good idea. And that, as they say, is that. That's all I have for you today. You have been listening to Radio Naturopath, the talk show about health and natural medicine. I am Fran Storch, ND, naturopathic physician. You can email me with questions and comments at radionaturopath@gmail.com. If you'd like to listen to the show at another time, you can check out our podcast at whus.org, iTunes, Spotify, Patreon, Buzzsprout, and YouTube. You may also watch the recorded Facebook Live episode at Fran Storch, ND. The views expressed on this program do not reflect the views of the staff, management, or licensee of this station. The information presented on this show should not be construed as medical advice or direction. If you're having a medical condition, please consult with your physician. Thank you for listening to Radio Naturopath, your show where you can learn about the best of science and nature. We'll be back with more Radio Naturopath next week at 91.7 FM, WHUS stores, and WHUS.org.